Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Hey, everybody, I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring important conversations with the unafraid. Thank you, Fearless community, for tuning in from across Canada and so many other countries like New Zealand, USA, Austria, UK, and so many more places, including a ton of listeners from Taiwan. Thank you. It's great to have all of you joining us. So my book, Fearless, Girls with Dreams, Women with Vision, continues to inspire because of the true, authentic, and incredibly inspiring stories in the book. Thank you again for making it a bestseller. Your support means the world to me. Can you please tell your friends to listen to the podcast and ask them to grab a copy of Fearless wherever you and they love to buy books? We want our community to grow, so spread the news. So I'm very excited to have this next guest on the show. Let me tell you a little bit about her. And I'm only just going to say a few things because otherwise we wouldn't even get to the show. She has such an incredible bio. Described by Forbes as the company's savvy CEO, Diane Scott is the chair and CEO of the JMCC Group. JMCC is the premier provider of Jamaican medical cannabis to the world. The business is growing fast with customers in Canada, Germany, Australia, and more. And hey, these are all countries where we have our loyal listeners. Diane is also an advisor to several corporations and nonprofit groups, and she speaks around the world. She's going to talk about that and so much more. Welcome to the show, Diane Scott.
Thank you, Janice. I'm really very excited and honored to be here today.
That's great. So let's jump right in. Can we talk about your current role and why you love it?
I am the co-founder of a venture capital firm headquartered overseas in London called SX2 Ventures. My partner, Tom Speechy, and I, we founded the firm together to focus on investing in areas we were really passionate about. We'd got to a point in our lives where we felt we could really do that. And so for us, that's really the areas of life sciences, things like emerging market healthcare, end of life care, mental health, nutraceuticals, meaning plant-based medicines such as ginger or, as you mentioned, medical cannabis. But one of the key components for us at SX2 is we require all of our investments to have a societal benefit. So they have to give back to the communities where our businesses are and leave a positive impact. You know, I guess when I think back to when we started the firm, Janice, we really decided that at that point in our careers, we'd earned the right to invest not just with our smarts and our expertise, but also with our hearts. So in addition to the traditional VC type measurements, we added the societal benefit requirement. But I really want to be clear, if you don't mind, that I'm not talking about impact investing. At SX2, right, we look at investments that are healthy ROIs, yes, very healthy financial positions, but we reject the notion that you have to compromise profit because your investment does benefit society in some way.
So, Diane, if I'm hearing you correctly, we're talking about more of the kind of 3P approach, you know, profit, yes, but people and planet. Is that kind of how you're,
100%.
How you're meaning it? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, you also mentioned I'm chair and CEO of JMCC Group. That is our biggest investment. JMCC, as you also mentioned, is focused on medicinal cannabis grown in Jamaica. We founded that company in Canada where we're headquartered, but our big operations is out of Jamaica. We did that in 2017. We're in five countries today. And from day one, we established the JMCC Foundation and committed to reinvest 10% of our net profits back into the surrounding communities. And so that's into areas like medical research, education. We grow in a farming collective, and our farmers own 51% of that collective. So it's really exciting to be a part of that kind of thing. And when you ask me why I love it, the things I love about my role is, you know, it's literally I spend my day working with amazing people from all walks of life. Our teams, our customers, our physicians all over the world. Right now with COVID, obviously I'm not traveling like I usually do, but I Zoom like everyone else. Right. And I usually start my day in the UK. You know, we're in the world's largest medical cannabis trial called T21, supporting 20,000 patients in the UK. Then Canada wakes up, Jamaica wakes up, Europe will be in there. And I end my day with the Australian team. So I'm getting to live this explosion and this realization of the incredible medical benefits of cannabis that's happening all over the world. And I get to do it right from the ground floor. And I love that.
So one of the things that I think is exciting when you reference your VC firm and then the strategic investments that you make based on those guiding principles that you've outlined is how exciting to be able to say, this is the way we want to do business and this is the way that we want to partner with people, like to have your values just baked right into everything you're doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I guess we just got to the point in our lives, you know, children, families, where your perspective changed significantly from when we were, you know, in the banking and legal world when we were younger. And we realize how incredibly important it is to contribute.
Yeah. And I just love also, though, you're creating the world that you want to see. Right? You're strategically investing but structuring things too, like you mentioned your foundation. So I think that's really exciting. Now, Diane, you talked about that there are incredible benefits about medical cannabis. And, you know, we also know in these days right now, it can be confusing where to get good information. So where should people go if they want to think about, you know, different options on how they approach health? Where can you point people?
So first of all, for me, I always tell people to start with their doctor. Mm-hmm. And again, I stress the word medical. In Canada, we have legalized for recreational use, which is great. You know, that's a completely different industry and market than what we focus on. We're talking about medicine. So it's, you know, the misconception here, Janice, is that this is a big cure-all. It's not. It is something that should be used in cooperation with your traditional medical approach. And so my advice is always start with your doctor. If your doctor does not have a lot of experience with medical cannabis, and thankfully that's happening less and less, then I also recommend that people reach out to the medical cannabis clinics we have here in Canada. For example, two of them, National Access Cannabis, or it's known as NAC, or Canadian Cannabis Clinics, they're all over the country. It's a very regulated but easy process. And so you effectively contact them. You will have a referral from your primary physician that will include your medical history. Then you will go to the clinic or zoom into the clinic and you'll be connected with a medical doctor who is experienced also with using medical cannabis to treat whatever condition you're using. And they'll create a program for you. In all cases, though, you're talking about doctors, clinics, and employees licensed by Health Canada with the highest possible standards. And you're going to receive a medicinal cannabis product that is grown and produced specifically for medical uses. So quality, no pesticides, no no heavy metals, nothing that's going to make your condition worse. And that's a really critical point. So please, please start with your doctor.
Love that. Right. I mean, that's just helpful. Start there. And then actually though, to your point, you can do some research and you can find some things out, but you have to take that same kind of informed approach.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Google can be amazing and it can also be really scary. And so I think, you know, learn what you can, but go to the experts, just like you would with any other medicine that you are going to take.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really helpful. So let's go back in time and tell us about the 10-year-old Diane. Where were you living? What were you into?
So this is a great question. Clearly, I haven't had this one before. 10-year-old me was actually a pretty well-behaved little girl. Let me think. My family, we were living in Whitby. And like my friends, I was probably into figure skating in the winter and ballet. Definitely crazy mad about clothes. Mom and I would go off shopping for something special, usually on Saturdays. And I, at that age, I can remember I probably was saving my pocket money, and my parents would kind of meet me halfway on outfits and shoes and bags, and love to be pretty, definitely girly, girly. Truthfully, I absolutely still am, except nobody helps me pay for my shoes now, unfortunately.
But the problem continues, is what you're saying.
It sure does.
So if I were to come over to your house, then you might have a shoe garden. It's just shoes.
I would have a lot of stuff to show you.
All right. So tell me about a time you were fearless, whether that was in your younger days or more recently in your business pursuits. What comes to mind when you think about Diane as fearless?
Definitely, I would say taking a job working for former U.S. presidential candidate, Mr. Ross Perot Sr. It was terrifying to me. My role was based in London with teams that were all over the world. I was in my late 20s, and I literally, it all happened really fast, and I had to find a tenant for the condo I just bought in Toronto, my first home. I jumped on a plane. I moved to London to run the marketing sales product arm of Perot Systems Financial Services practice.
Can you back up for a second, Diane? Can you just back up? Tell us how Diane in Toronto ends up, like, how did this even unfold? What happened? What were the steps that made this opportunity land for you?
I would say to you, like most times in my career when there's been a shift, it happened by accident, truthfully. Okay. Like, it's not something went out to look for, Janice, but when I went to work for Mr. Perot, I had been working for a very large financial services organization here in Canada, based in Toronto, with Canadian responsibility. I had been sent overseas to INSEAD to go to school. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, I had had a taste of being overseas and said, you know, I really think I'd like an international assignment. And at that time, there wasn't one available for me in the group. So I just simply had mentioned to a few people, you know, I had loved the experience and I would like to take a time overseas in my career at some point. And then I had this opportunity. I got the call from the gentleman who ran this practice out of London, who had heard from different people. And that's really how it happened. And then ultimately, after many, many interviews, I ended up working for Mr. Perot Sr.
Wow. So you kind of set an intention of global experience and then off you went on your adventure.
Indeed, yes. And I was 29 years old at the time. So I'm in London. I don't know a single soul. Amazing city.
Yeah.
I was young and a woman, and I entered the most male-dominated industry and, quite frankly, business culture you could ever imagine. And I was terrified.
What did that teach you, or what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I had teams all over, Janice. And so, for example, I started traveling to the Middle East. And certainly it was nowhere near as open as it is today. As a woman in business, very frustrating, sometimes scary. So it taught me patience. And it taught me how to be really firm, but not offensive. Because in those markets...
Say more. Yeah, tell us more. What do you mean?
Yeah, in a market that is culturally not as open to women in those positions. And then you arrive, you have to respect the fact that it's going to take people time to get used to you, and also for you to understand how things work in that particular geography and that particular culture. So that was a lesson. Also was traveling to Russia at the time. Russia taught me to hold my tongue. It also, you know, taught me to push, because, you know, at first you have to politely sit, but you can't sit forever in Russia. You have to push or it's not going to happen. So, you know, again, working in fairly closed places, sometimes frightening, but I was really lucky, because over time, I think I'm a hard worker. I think I have a reputation for being pretty firm and fair. And I also learned how critical it is to respect the cultural differences. So eventually won over, you know, my banking partners, and they would end up going to bat for me. And it made working in foreign markets much easier for me.
What's the source of your confidence that, you know, gave you that boldness to actually go into these challenging situations and new adventures?
I have to say my childhood.
How so?
You know, I was raised by two people, two parents who, quite frankly, were amazing. I have two older brothers who are also like parents, because there's a significant age difference. So for me, I had all of them kind of pushing me in a way that said, you can do anything. And I was a good student. I wasn't the most brilliant, but I was a good student. And I worked hard. I started working as soon as I was old enough to have a social insurance number. My first job was Dairy Queen, because I thought that made
That's
me grown up.
One.
And I loved, yeah, it was very hard. And I loved having a paycheck, quite frankly, to buy clothes. My parents were kind of strict with us in some ways, in terms of we all had chores that had to get done. And, you know, supper was every day at 6 o'clock as a family. We came home when the streetlights came on. And, you know, as we got older, we didn't use bad language, or still wouldn't in front of my mom. So my parents gave us and taught us values, I think, Janice, that I live by today. I'm a little traditional, maybe old fashioned, but
what does
I think
that mean?
I think it's like my moral fiber, right? It's, I know if I stay true to who I am, I'm not going to go wrong. And I think that, I guess, is where the confidence comes from.
Yeah. Your guiding principles. It's a good way to go through each day. That's for sure. So
I think also they change over time, right? You know, your guiding principles, you have your core values, and then the older you get, you realize other things may be more important to you now than they were previously, right? When you're older, all of a sudden the importance of family, for example, becomes much more aware in your life than maybe when you're in your 20s.
Mm-hmm. So what about criticism? How do you take that in stride? Because as a successful woman and leader, sometimes that can draw different perspectives on your performance or
yeah.
So how do you manage that?
This is a tough one for me, as I think I'm still a work in progress on this, Janice. I really do. I think you always have to look at where the criticism is coming from. And I think that, again, is another massive lesson that I have learned and probably had to relearn multiple times in my career. I'm thinking back to, I lived and worked in New York City for 7 years, and, you know, still in the financial services industry, working directly with like five biggest banks. I worked in a consortium that they owned. And again, a very male-dominated industry and time in business. And I think I had to have a much tougher, thicker skin than any other time in my career. And it was really hard, to be honest. While I loved the challenge of my job, it was a really difficult environment. And I dealt with pretty regularly with criticism from my male colleagues who just were not used to having a female sitting at the executive table, or quite frankly, as a boss in some cases. And it used to send me crazy angry, I'd be sitting on the subway going home and silently telling them off in my head or reliving what I should have said to them. And then, you know, truthfully, two things happened to me. There was a lovely woman named Barbara DeSore, who was executive vice president at Bank of America. And Barbara was very kind to me. She really led by example. Her work was exceptional. She was brilliant. Her responses in the boardroom were always really well thought out. And she became kind of my role model. And I wanted to emulate how she was. And so I focused on the work and not the nonsense. And that seemed to help me immensely. You know, ultimately, Barbara ended up being my sponsor at Harvard Business School, and her leadership really left a mark on me. The other thing I would add about taking criticism is sometimes even after all of your hard work and all of your self-work, quite frankly, you still have people who or groups that are criticizing you in this kind of environment. And if you can't respect it, then you have another option, and that is to leave. And I did actually end up doing that as well, because I just woke up one morning and realized I was a pretty angry, negative person, and I didn't like who I had become to do my job every day. And so ultimately, I decided it wasn't the right place for me, and I left, took a year off, dabbled in some projects, and then that's when Tom and I founded SX2.
So, you know, that's a powerful statement to talk about, you know, this self-reflection where you realize, as you said, I didn't like who I, you know, had to become in order to do the job. It's a bold move to leave your career, especially one that is, you know, giving you so many other things. What's your advice for others who are ready or they're forced to consider a change? How did you, like, I know you have the self-awareness piece, but what else went into making that bold decision?
I think I really had at the time, if I'm looking back, I really had spent, you know, I was exhausted by the negativity, and I really had spent enough time there, in my opinion, and said, you know, I can be proud of my work. I can be proud of how I've handled things for the most part. And I think if I don't make this change for myself, I'm not going to be proud of how I handle things. And so I think that when you make those kind of abrupt changes, you have to figure out whether you believe enough that you're going to find your next big thing. And I think at the time, Janice, I was exhausted, so I wasn't really thinking about my next big thing. I just had faith it was coming. And so, you know, I get asked this question in a similar way, which is, you know, what's the advice for others in thinking about change or thinking about their next big career move? And, you know, I would say, particularly to other women, that my biggest advice is you are enough. And I think as women, we have a lot of doubt sometimes ingrained in us. And the truth is if you believe in your capability, even if no one else does, you're going to get there. And I 100% believe that. So you just have to believe you are enough to do whatever it is that you want to do.
Super inspiring and such a powerful, simple statement, but packs a big punch. That's for sure. You are enough. So Diane, what about, because you've had such a fascinating career to date and you're just getting started, frankly, what's a pinch me moment from your career? If you have one, well, there must be 100 probably.
I'm not exaggerating, Janice, when I say that this was actually very humbling for me. To be in the company of the people on this podcast, and I'm not just saying this, I had taken a review of some of your past amazing women, Honorable Mary Ng and, you know, Madame Sophie Gregoire, Vicky Saunders. I'm an extremely proud CEO activator, by the way. I love what Vicky's creating with her fund, and Sarah Richardson and what she's built with her brand. Love it. So this was truly a little bit of a wow moment for me. So thank you for that.
Oh, shucks.
But if I had to give you another specific moment, I'm definitely going to go back to flying to Dallas to interview with Ross Perot. Obviously extremely intimidating, and really, regardless of what you think of his politics, he was a larger than life personality, and I was nervous, probably as nervous as I've ever been. I met him in his office at the Perot Foundation. This would be August 2000-ish, and I had to wade through a scrum of reporters waiting outside to see if he was going to announce that he was going to run against George W. Bush for election. So that was a little nerve-wracking to start out my interview. And then I remember going into his office, and he has this Russian cosmonaut suit hanging, and he has a moon rock as a gift, and it's a really interesting place. But I'll tell you that Mr. Perot Sr. is an old-school gentleman, and he went to such great lengths to make me comfortable. And ultimately, we had a lovely conversation and really less of an interview. And I remember in the end, he said to me, well, are you going to come and work for me? And I remember I was really concerned about him running for office because I would have been running the press office in London for Perot Systems. And I don't know really how to do that when you have someone running for U.S. president. So secretly inside, I was kind of freaking out and, you know, thinking, how am I going to handle this? And he laughed, and I said to him when I explained it, and he said, now come on, little lady. That's something he would call me for the rest of the time I worked for him. Are you going to come work for me? And I said, well, sir, and something I called him for the entire time I worked for him, perhaps you can tell me if you're going to run for president. And he laughed and he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to come back to you on that. And I'm going to talk to Marg, which is his wife and the family and a few others, and then I'll let you know. And I said, well, that's great, sir. And once you've done all that and you let me know, then I'll let you know. And we both had a chuckle at that. And of course, I went to work for him, and I never really looked back. It was a terrifying experience, and I'm actually a little nervous thinking about it now. But I really loved working with him.
Must have been an incredible adventure.
It was really an incredible adventure.
So, what's something you've done that you wouldn't want to do again?
Bungee jumping. Terrified me. I did it for an employee morale thing. Never need to do it again. I did it in Toronto.
Okay.
There was a place, I think, called the Rocks or something down in the harbor, and it was an employee morale thing. The executives would go up on this ginormous crane to a platform, and I remember going up, and there was some cheeky person who said, hey, can I have your jewelry, Diane, if it all goes wrong? And I kind of remember thinking, this might be the stupidest thing I've ever done. And I was really not well for hours after. There was no thrill. So yeah, no, I'm never doing that again.
So what would be something that people might be surprised to know about you, aside from clearly a beautiful jewelry?
And great shoes. I'm a homebody. I think that's what most people who I work with around the world or would be surprised. You know, I travel almost every week all over the world in pre-COVID world. And there's nothing I love more than coming home, which I try to do every single weekend. I've noticed the older I'm getting, I actually have a physical reaction where my entire body relaxes when the car comes through my gate. And I think people view me because our business is global and because it takes me to faraway places, and I certainly have had many amazing opportunities and met incredible people and incredible minds. So I think that brings some kind of image. You know, for Janice, I'll give you an example. When we started working in Jamaica, I was extremely lucky and blessed because one of Jamaica's former prime ministers, Edward Siaga, he was arguably one of the founding fathers of the country, author of their constitution. He took me under his wing, and he was my mentor until his death last year. And, you know, that kind of thing creates an impression in people's minds, I think, when they see that's who you're interacting in. But the truth is, I come home to the town I was raised in, to my family and my childhood friends. I love nothing more than, you know, Sunday family supper at my house, which is usually 20 or 30 people. I cook for them. I potter around my kitchen. You know, it's full of people and there's kids running around and filled with laughter. And, you know, I'm a homebody and I'm a pretty simple girl.
Well, a simple girl with lots of shoes and great joy, if I hear you correctly. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's beautiful. So here's the final question, Diane. What's your dream for Canada?
Wow, what a question. Great question. I love Canada, and I am grateful every single day for the foundation being Canadian gives me. The family values, the cultural diversity, the melting pot, I think, as we used to call it, you know, the different races and cultures that make up the country. I'm grateful for the education system that I grew up with and quite frankly, the financial stability of our nation, which is helping us navigate a pretty tumultuous time right now, as it did in 2008 with the subprime meltdown that the world was struggling with. So, you know, I look at all that and then there's no doubt that being Canadian has given me a leg up in business in foreign markets. Canada's brand is friendly and likable and kind, but not a pushover. We're fair and I'm proud of that. So to answer your question with all of that in mind, my dream for Canada is that things I am proud of continue and grow for future generations. And for that to happen, Janice, we have to first recognize and be proud of what makes us Canadian and then protect it, meaning not completely throwing away our past, but rather learning from it, holding on to all that has made us a great nation, letting go of what no longer serves us, and then enhancing all of that with the changes necessary to ensure that we continue to represent the qualities that make us Canada, the qualities that command respect here at home, but also far beyond our borders. I guess the qualities that make Canada, well, Canada, really.
You've been listening to, as Forbes described, the savvy CEO, Diane Scott. She just shared a beautiful dream for Canada. She is the chair and CEO of JMCC Group, among her many roles and accomplishments. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, Diane Scott. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Fearless Women podcast.
Thank you, Janice. It was really a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors, BDC, Lockheed Martin, and Export Development Canada. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to Export Development Canada, the international risk experts, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. Supporting Canadian companies of all sizes succeed on the world stage, EDC takes your worries away and helps you grow your business with confidence. When your business has no borders, neither does your potential. Find out more at edc.ca/womenintrade. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.